Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. There's a certain consistency to the humor of Donald Trump and Martin Shkreli. You know who Donald Trump is? In case you don't know Martin Shkreli, he's the New York guy who became infamous a few years ago as the so-called pharma bro for jacking up the price of a life-saving AIDS medication. This summer, Shkreli was convicted of lying to investors about a variety of things concerning his company and his track record. The conviction wasn't about the price gouging. Being greedy in the pharmaceutical industry is not a crime, for better or for worse, but securities fraud is. Shkreli, channeling Trump, called it a witch hunt and said someone should drain the swamp at the Justice Department. Shkreli is awaiting sentencing, and last week, as you may have heard, the judge in the case revoked Shkreli's bail and put him behind bars. Why? Well, he made an offer on Facebook to pay $5,000 to anyone who could bring a strand of Hillary Clinton's hair while she's on her book tour. That was considered a physical threat against an individual, so his bail was revoked. Shkreli's defense, it was just a harmless joke. Donald Trump, over the weekend, tweeted a joke video. It depicts him hitting a golf ball and then the golf ball hitting Hillary Clinton in the head and knocking her over. Hearty har har, a regular laugh riot, that Donald Trump. Well, we have no word on whether the golf ball knocked loose a strand of Clinton's hair that Trump can use to get the reward from Shkreli. But what a bizarre coincidence, if it is a coincidence, Trump and Shkreli both making jokes about assaulting Hillary Clinton in the head. No one is yet revoking Trump's bail for making a physical threat, but this is the world we are now living in today. Martin Shkreli and Donald Trump, social media comedians and bros under the skin. Perhaps it was with that in mind that the Emmy Awards last night featured a few funnies of their own. Here's a sampling.
We know that the biggest TV star of the last year is Donald Trump. Yeah. No, may not like it, but he's the biggest star. And we all know the Emmys mean a lot to Donald Trump because he was nominated multiple times for Celebrity Apprentice, but he never won. Why didn't you give him an Emmy? I tell you this, if he had won an Emmy, I bet he wouldn't have run for president.
I suppose I should say, at long last, Mr. President, here is your Emmy.
I want to thank Trump for making black people number one on the most oppressed list.
We did have a whole storyline about an impeachment, but we abandoned that because we were worried that someone else might get to it first.
Stephen Colbert, Alec Baldwin, Danny Glover, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus from last night's Emmy Awards. Let's bring on our first guest. It's Ed O'Keefe, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. His article on Saturday called "With Little to Lose, Democrats Cautiously Share the Driver's Seat with Trump." Thanks for coming on, Ed. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian. Happy Monday.
Did you happen to watch the Emmys last night and how they handled the political moments?
So, Brian, I had a hunch, an unreported hunch, that there would be a Sean Spicer moment. And I'm glad that in the first 25 minutes they got it out of the way. I saw that. And then I watched Ken Burns because the Vietnam War documentary thing has started and,
and
a bunch of shows that I don't watch were going to win anyway, right?
Right. Perspective, right? A little perspective, turning away from the Emmys to watch Ken Burns, who, by the way, will be on the show with his co-producer, Lynn Novick, in a couple of days to talk about that documentary series. Well, you got that tip about Sean Spicer. I mean, it was pretty self-deprecating for him to kind of play himself as being played by Melissa McCarthy on Saturday Night Live. Why do you think he went along with the joke? I mean, it's kind of an insult, the whole thing, you know, the Saturday Night Live original. Why do you think he went along with it?
I suspect somebody who is advising him on his post-White House career has told him that the only way he's going to be able to resurrect himself or sort of smooth over the edges is by fully embracing, as Nancy Pelosi would say, embracing the suck And that is sort of embracing the issue that was for him, and that, you know, that he was the face and the voice of this administration. And so he just feels compelled to sort of get in on the joke. And what I don't think he's entirely grasped is that people are still laughing at him, not with him.
Well, I didn't actually see the Emmys either, but I was struck by the review in the New York Times, which said last year, with Trump having just been nominated, the humor directed at him was raw and tense. Last night, it was more contained and delivered with more polish than outrage. And I thought, this is how normalization works. Most people can't stay in a state of amped up outrage permanently. So the humor aimed at someone they see as a true bigot and true threat goes from raw last year to polished this year. And people kind of shrug when he tweets a joke depicting, you know, felonious assault against a woman who was his political opponent. I mean, maybe this is a stretch, but is it somewhat in this context, as your headline puts it, that Democrats are cautiously sharing the driver's seat with Trump?
I think what we saw play out, you're referring to the negotiations with the president now over the future of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. I think what's important to keep in mind to Chuck Schumer points out, he has been saying since the transition, we will oppose you when it makes sense to oppose you, but we will work with you, Mr. President, if there are ways and reasons to work with you. In this case, there's a legitimate reason to work with him because they want to save the fate of at least 690,000 people who are currently enrolled in the program, if not, you know, just over a million who have at one point or another been enrolled in it or would apply or would be eligible. They got plenty of blowback last week from their more liberal colleagues about the fact that they were doing this. And as the minority leader said to me in an interview, he said, look, Ed, if at the end of this nothing has changed, then nothing has changed. The president will still be in his perilous political position, and we're going to have to quickly find another way to solve the DACA issue. But why wouldn't we at least attempt to talk to him about this if we think that there's a possibility of a deal? And to anyone who's listening and who goes, I can't believe that they would do this, you're probably the same people who were saying or who have said repeatedly, I don't understand why Congress can't work with the White House. And you've probably been saying that for more than a decade. So here they are now trying to cut a deal, and people are upset about it or people are worried about it. And that's understandable because you're worried that your side's going to give in or give away too much. But at the same time, isn't this exactly what everyone's been wanting, the two parties to talk to each other and try to cut a deal?
Right.
So, well, I think in that respect, they have tried to do something here, and we'll see where it goes.
There's a lot of ambiguity about what kind of DACA deal Trump and Schumer and Pelosi are actually in the process of making. How clear is it to you that there even is one, or what it would be?
It's not clear to me right now by any means what it will be. In fact, in talking to one aide familiar with the ongoing deliberations this morning, it's not entirely clear what exactly they're negotiating and what exactly they're looking at. So that's only one person, but I think that gives you a sense that for now, everyone's pleased that there's an appearance of agreement and that there's an appearance of negotiations. The problem is the actual negotiations haven't begun. We don't know the details, and I think there's a lot of concern on both sides that the moment that the details get revealed to people like me, frankly, or in reporting, that then people are really going to get upset or really excited, depending on what side of the debate you're on, and that's going to cause some trouble. So we'll see. If you ask me again on Friday what are the details and are they talking and they haven't started talking, I'd be concerned. But it's only Monday morning, and at this point, you know, there's still a general agreement that they're going to try to sort this out.
On Friday's show, I put a version of this normalization question to Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from here in New York. Does it risk normalizing Trump to make deals with him when so many Democrats see him as racist, sexist, nativist, homophobic, etc.? And here's what she said, responding to anyone who may have doubts about whether to do that because of Trump's views.
I understand their instinct, and, you know, President Trump has done some very, very hateful things, and he said some very, very awful things. But I do believe in something that's really important, Brian. If we're not helping people, we should go home. And it doesn't matter who you're working with. I have a bipartisan bill on nearly everything I care about. And, you know, if President Trump's willing to pass paid leave, a national paid leave program, I will work with him on that. If he's willing to pass the DREAM Act, we all will work with him on that. So I recognize how frustrating that is for folks on the ground. But the reality is if he's doing something good, you're not normalizing his hate. If he's doing something hateful, you don't work with him on that.
Senator Gillibrand here on Friday. Ed, is that pretty much the universal attitude among Democrats in Congress? They're willing to do business with Trump on DACA and any other areas of common ground rather than just turn his back, their backs on him because of other things that are hateful that he said or done?
It is. And the fact that it's coming from somebody like Senator Gillibrand is notable and I think indicative of where most of the Democratic parties, or at least on Capitol Hill, is at on this issue. Remember, she's somebody who has voted against virtually all of his nominees this year. She's taken to using four-letter words to describe her disgust and concern about where things are. And she's somebody who's thinking about running for president. She also, in the last 2 weeks, had a meeting with the president in the Oval Office along with other New York and New Jersey lawmakers to talk about the future of that tunnel under the Hudson River to salvage the Northeast Corridor train line. And I think that's a perfect example of her saying, if there's somewhere he wants to work with us to help people, I've got to do that. And where, on what other issue but transportation in the tri-state area does that make more sense? And that's why she showed up. And that's why Chuck Schumer's willing to take the meeting on DACA. It's why if for some reason, you know, certain Democrats are approached on the issue of tax reform, they are willing to work with the president because it's good for their politics back home, but also because they want and they understand that it's better to have both parties consulted. And, you know, it just makes sense right now. And again, anger with Trump is one thing, but look at the polling. Congress is a more reviled institution right now than the presidency. They understand they've got to get some wins on the board. And if that means working with Trump, they'll do it.
By the way, a couple of corrections. I think I said Danny Glover before. It was, of course, Donald Glover at the Emmys last night. And I said the golf ball in that made-up Trump video hits Hillary Clinton in the head. It actually hits her in the back, but it still knocks her over and basically same thing. So listeners, if you're a Democrat or progressive or anyone else horrified by Trump, are you willing to have Democrats in Congress make a deal because protecting DACA recipients is that important? Or anyone in the no business with Trump camp, no normalization, is anyone like that left? Or anything else you want to bring up about, I don't know, Trump and Shkreli humor, lines at the Emmys, or take your pick, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, with Washington Post congressional correspondent Ed O'Keefe, 212-433-9692. Ed, following up on what you were just saying, how would you compare the extent to which Democrats in Congress are willing to compromise with Trump to the extent the Republicans were willing to compromise with Obama? There was that famous Rush Limbaugh and Mitch McConnell moment, or two separate moments close in time at the very beginning of the Obama presidency, that said basically the only goal is to make him a one-term president. So, you know, by implication, no compromise on DACA, no compromise on cap and trade, which McCain also supported and was originally a Republican proposal, just climate denial after that, so that Obama would not have any legislative successes. So how would you compare the congressional opposition in each president's first year?
Well, he's been opposed, certainly, by Democrats so far this year. The problem is that Democrats were the ones that rewrote the rules in the Senate and really reduced their ability as the minority party to stop things. They can slow things down, but they really can't stop anything anymore. They can't stop nominees. And under the rules that Republicans were trying to use, if they had succeeded, they wouldn't have been able to stop the repeal of the Affordable Care Act that Republicans were toiling with most of the summer in the Senate. So it hasn't been that different. And certainly in some ways it's been even more strident because they're concerned about Trump as a man, as a president, as what he represents. And I don't think there's any Democrat who would tell you publicly or privately that they want to see Donald Trump reelected. But they understand that 8 years of friction and lack of cooperation in Washington wasn't good for anybody. And so, again, going back to Leader Schumer, who has said, we're not going to obstruct for obstruction's sake. We're going to obstruct when we disagree with you, and we will more than willing work with you on issues that we agree with. And so that's why they're trying to work together on DACA. That's why they're trying to work together on building a new rail tunnel under the Hudson River. That's why they're trying to work with them on tax reform, but Republicans refuse to talk to them about it. Same goes for health care. They wanted to talk to Republicans about it. They're cutting them out. So, you know, they're there and they're willing to do it. And I think it's been vividly demonstrated in their quick willingness and eagerness to talk to him about DACA.
Yeah.
And their attitude is, let's talk about other things. And notable that last week.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Notable. Well, just notable that in that conversation that they had over dinner last week, they didn't talk first about DACA and only about DACA. They first talked about trade with China. Both parties understand that there's some concern with that. They also tried talking about salvaging the healthcare issue, but there was no agreement there. So, you know, Democrats are trying, and they're waiting to see whether Republicans want to engage with them.
Ari in Midwood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ari.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I definitely think that the Democrats need to work with Trump where they can. It would be unthinkable to let the people on DACA just get hurt and get deported because we want to make this stand against him that we don't accept him as a human being. We can say he's revolting and disgusting and unfit for the presidency, but we have to do what we have to do to protect people. And it would actually be great revenge to co-opt him and basically turn him against the Republicans. I think that would be hysterical and really smart play by the Democrats.
Ari, thank you very much. So sort of to follow up on that, and then to come from the Trump side of what you were just describing, you know, from the Democrat side on a possible DACA deal, and it even relates to the golf ball attack video, because some political analysts are now seeing that video as the opposite of what I think the going narrative was for a long time. It used to be Trump would do something reasonable once in a while, then he would tweet something outrageous, and the media would say the reasonableness was fake and the real Trump is coming through again in the tweets. Now, Ed, I'm starting to hear the opposite. Trump wants to make bipartisan deals on immigration, on the Paris Climate Agreement, maybe on health care, and when the Breitbart crowd goes bonkers and starts burning Make America Great Again hats, which I gather happened in the last few days because of the possible DACA deal, he tweets out something like the Strike Hillary golf ball video to show the base he's still one of them. But now the analysis is that the tweet is fake and that the DACA dealing Trump is the real Donald Trump. Do you see the shift in analysis? And if you have an opinion, do you think it's accurate?
Well, I can see the shift in analysis, and I don't usually share my opinions, but I can understand why some people would start now to read things that way. And I don't know if that's you know, sort of hope that that's really what he's up to, or just, you know, some shift in reality given the way that his staffing has shaken out in the last few weeks, the departure of Steve Bannon, the departure of Sean Spicer, Reince Priebus, and others, and the idea that John Kelly is now perhaps exacting a little more discipline there at the White House and the president's true colors are coming out. I just think over and over again, you know, you just have to sort of expect the unexpected with him, expect it to be somewhat outlandish or dramatic. And this is a guy who wants to surprise, who wants to disrupt, who thrives on that, who loves to know that he's causing confusion and sowing doubts and anger in certain people and keeping his base happy. And so, you know, if all of this helps him do that, he's going to keep it up. And I think it's telling. My colleague Jenna Johnson, who covered the Trump campaign like nobody else and has now devoted herself to really continuing to document and understand his base of support, has a report out this morning that's on our website from North Carolina, where she talked to a collection of his supporters who say they're happy to see him working with Democrats, because they understand that Republicans have not necessarily been cooperative to him. And if there's a way to get a deal with Democrats, then go ahead and get a deal with Democrats. That kind of thinking is the kind of thing that really does disrupt Washington, because now it scrambles everything. And they're going to have to realize that there's new ways of working together. You've got to look out for those ideas that are bipartisan and that can bring people into a room. And, you know, it's going to cause great consternation and confusion. But that's the way he operates, and that's what he wants to see happening here in Washington.
And to that point, about the Trump supporters and who they really are versus who their media image is, I've seen Katie Turr, the fierce NBC News reporter who covered Trump so aggressively and closely during the campaign and is now an anchor on MSNBC. She's got her new book, and she is certainly not one to be soft on Donald Trump in any way. but I've seen her a few times now in book interviews say the Trump supporters are not essentially the Breitbart crowd. They're essentially a much, much more eclectic mix than that, that wants to see the kind of disruption you were just describing. And so if Trump is smart, he should be ready to throw over the Breitbart crowd, let them burn their Make America Great Again hats, because there's actually more for him to gain with the people who actually voted for him than by just appealing to that certain part of the base.
Yep, exactly. And that's why so many here in Washington still think, believe, predict that ultimately he may run for re-election as an independent, or may really only be a RINO, a Republican in name only, and yet he's operating in different ways, and yet his base doesn't mind and will continue voting for him. So, you know, if you really thought he was going to be a disruptor, that's the way he'll be a disruptor. And that's what may have made last week and what we'll see play out this week if they continue talking so important and dramatic and potentially much more consequential than a lot of what we've seen so far this year.
Right. But he still has a lot of making up to do for his either bigotry in his heart or his willingness or his willingness to use bigotry so cavalierly throughout the campaign and throughout his presidency so far to score a few political points with somebody somebody or other before we can call him some kind of, you know, independent disruptor who's having a positive effect. My guest is Ed O'Keefe, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post, and Chandra in Long Island City. You're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hey, good morning. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
My comment is the Democrats need to work with the president completely and also teach a lesson not only to the president, also to the Republicans that they are not obstructionists, because they've been telling that Democrats are always obstructing and whatever, so they have to prove that point and also go on national TV and social media and everywhere, and there's no business like show business kind of attitude has to come out from the Democrats, whether they are charismatic leaders or not. You know, they have to do with whatever they have, and they have to drive the point home that they mean good for the country, not only for their own people and things like that. So on that basis, they need to work with the president and get their agenda also passed. They don't have to agree on everything, but they need to work with him.
Chandra, thank you so much. Liz in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Liz.
Thanks so much for taking my call. It's a great day when I get to be quoted as a Democrat in the paper of record, and I get to be on your show.
Were you quoted as a Democrat in the Times today?
Yeah, I was quoted in the story that how Democrats and Republicans get to pick their successors. I'm the one who said that I think the system sucks. But I am a Democrat. I'm a member of the Democratic Party. I worked really hard for Hillary Clinton. I cannot believe that Trump is our president, and it mortifies me every day. But the reality is, he is our president, and when there's stuff that we agree with him on, like DACA, like taxes, like transportation, infrastructure, he's the guy in the White House, and the country doesn't work if we don't work together on the stuff where we agree. And we should continue to call him out for being a racist and a bigot and a misogynist. But if he's got the right idea on stuff that's important to us, we have to work with that.
Liz, thank you very much. And I will say, for what it's worth, it's a very informal, unofficial, totally unscientific kind of poll, but all of our Democratic callers on our board are basically saying the same thing and are ready to work with him where they can find common ground on policy. But again, I think historically, this is different than the Republicans in Congress at the beginning of the Obama administration, where they could have found common ground on some kind of healthcare system reform that included free market elements that, you know, were in Romney Care originally, that Obama adopted for Obamacare, that were in the cap and trade system for the ozone layer that Obama then adopted, tried to for climate change, that was a Republican market-oriented approach to some degree. They could have found common ground, and they refused to, so that Obama would fail. So I just think it's important, unless you see it differently, to make that distinction for the sake of history.
It is. And you know, it's just... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think to your point about this being different, I think part of the reason it's different in talking to Democratic lawmakers over the last year is they saw the damage that the obstruction did. It was damaging not only to their party. Many believe it was damaging because they ended up with Donald Trump in response to that. Mm. It was damaging to Washington. It's been damaging to the country. And now, again, what does it tell you that all of your callers this morning who are Democrats are saying, let's get beyond this and let's cooperate? Everyone here in Washington is beginning to understand cooperation has to happen, that we need to be demonstrating some of that. They're going to burn off health care. They're going to burn off tax reform. And you know, he got his conservative on the Supreme Court. But going forward, they've got to find, as modest as it may be, bipartisan ways to work together and demonstrate it. If not, Republicans probably will get the boot in big numbers next year as voters say, Why should we have more of the same when it hasn't worked under both a Democratic president and now a Republican president?
Well, if they do make the deals, we'll see. Maybe it will work to the advantage of Republican incumbents in the House, and it'll be harder for Democrats to take the House because it'll look like things are working. Maybe it'll be harder for Kirsten Gillibrand or anybody else who might run for president in 2020 to actually defeat Trump if it looks like they're working. So that's the risk, I guess, they take. You know, we're having Governor Andrew Cuomo on later in the show this morning, and he's skeptical of the DACA deal, the way it seems to be emerging, because he says the Democrats have DACA already. It is the policy of the United States, and there are lawsuits to protect it. So they're getting nothing, and they're giving away too much else on immigration, whatever the beefed up border security and extra ICE agents and things like that turn out to be. Is he the only one making that argument so far as you know, as a congressional reporter?
I hadn't seen that, and that's telling. Of course, this is a governor who doesn't always see eye to eye with his senior senator from New York, so he may just not like the idea that his senior senator is getting to cut a deal with the president, and he's not. That said, they both were in the meeting with the president a few weeks ago discussing the Gateway Project. I think the point the governor's making is one that other Democrats have made, is it was working. It may or may not be unconstitutional, but it was working, and these people were protected. Why do you have to muck that up and potentially get some other things for conservatives regarding border security?
Right.
What I think everyone has said down here in Washington is there will be no wall as part of this deal. What you may see are elements of agreements that were put in place in 2013 that the Senate tried to pass and then the House ignored regarding immigration. You might see more drones on the border. You might see more helicopters circling overhead. And they may hire some more personnel, but I think most of it is equipment to try to tell whether or not people are coming across the border illegally. And yet all this money and effort will be spent at a time when DHS reports that illegal border crossings are down, and down considerably. And whether that's because of improving economic conditions or concerns about the fight going on here about the future of immigrants, unclear. But they're going to put all these things in place for a threat that doesn't entirely exist anymore. And so the governor, has every right to say that. And it's telling that he's saying that, frankly. You should also ask him about his trip to the Virgin Islands last week. I didn't realize that governors normally make those kinds of trips.
Yes.
I think a lot of people saw that as telling as well about the governor and his future. But, totally understandable that Democrats would be concerned that their leaders may be giving away the store. But all indications so far is that's not happening.
Governor Cuomo coming up at 11 o'clock, by the way. We've got about 3 minutes left. And I actually want to touch on, now that we've established that, it looks like Trump is trying to work with Democrats in some way on DACA. Two other areas, just very briefly, where it may happen next. Another one raising eyebrows on both sides is about possible moderation on the Paris Climate Accords, even after he announced we're pulling out. Here is National Security Advisor General McMaster putting it gently yesterday on ABC This Week.
So what the president has said is that we're withdrawing from the Paris Accord. He left the door open to reentering at some later time, if there can be a better deal for the United States.
Ed, can you tell what's going on with Trump and the Paris Treaty? Is he softening?
I think this is just like every other issue, Brian. He's trying to have it both ways. He's trying to keep, his supporters happy, but he's trying to acknowledge that maybe, what he promised during the campaign isn't realistic. And, McMaster said it. The Secretary of State said it. Nobody said point blank they're pulling out. what they said is if there's a way to get some modifications and get something better for the United States, whatever better may be, they'll stick with it. And that's telling. I think this perhaps more than other issues, is an example of the growing influence of those who aren't Steve Bannon, who are now left in the West Wing. Gary Cohn, his national economic advisor, is running point on this. This is somebody who comes from that sort of more global look at the world attitude and approach to politics and to these types of issues. And so that to me says that people in the White House who remain are telling the president, we've got to find a way to work through this that allows you to make it look as if we've gotten a better deal for Americans and fulfill your promise, but also, frankly, look out for the climate of this world, which is clearly changing. Mm. And I think if this is true, that they are still trying to find a way to get an agreement, and the fact that this comes as all these world leaders are in New York this week with the president for the UN General Assembly, this is another one that could really upset his base. And it'll be interesting to see how he plays it.
And last thing, and I think we should probably do a separate segment on this as this week goes on, but on health care, most of the headlines have been about Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill and how much mainstream Democratic support it's getting, Senator Gillibrand and others. But there's also a new Republican bill, as you know, that would turn very much of health care over to the states. And there's a right. September 30th deadline for Congress to pass it in the so-called reconciliation framework, which would mean the Senate could do it with just 51 votes, not 60. Is this Lindsey Graham, Bill Cassidy bill to radically transform the healthcare system quietly gaining steam without much press coverage?
It is, but you should expect a lot of press coverage this week. It'll be issue number one for the Senate. The House is out this week because of the Jewish holiday. The Senate leaves after Wednesday. Between now and Wednesday, it is all that Democrats want to talk about to warn their constituents, their supporters, that Republicans are going to try to ram this through next week. They have to do it by September 30th to use the current procedural rules that are in place. If they don't, then Republicans essentially have to restart the clock, restart the entire process of trying to undo the Affordable Care Act. And I think if they don't do it by next week, they're going to have to acknowledge it's done for now. They've got to salvage the ACA and return to this issue in the future.
Ed O'Keefe, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post, thank you so much for being our first guest this week.
Take care, Brian.